You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello, and welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Today, we're taking on a trip around Ireland with author June Gosler Anderson, who's here to discuss her latest book, Hauntings and History of the Emerald Isle. Part travelogue and part paranormal investigation, June's book covers some of Ireland's most notable haunted locations, and often the tragic histories behind these famous ghosts and hauntings. We look at the infamous Lepp Castle, the scene of some brutal murders and frightening apparitions, Enniscarthy Castle, which saw tragedy release spirits, June's experiences with table tipping, and some rather amorous and cheeky spirits, as well as several different hauntings from Duncannon Fort. We also discuss one of the ghosts from June's hometown of Anoka, the infamous grey-clad ghost, one of those unique modern hauntings that still tantalises. June's book is released via Beyond the Fray Publishing, and a big thank you to June for joining me today. You can also catch me as a guest host on this week's episode of The Ghost Story Guys, as I join Brennan to discuss some listener encounters with animal ghosts, as well as a couple of my personal favourite stories. As always, you can support the show via our Patreon. You can find the link to sign up in this week's show notes as usual. We're also across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube as usual. As always, artwork for the show is by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from The Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is pleased to be part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let's join June Gosler Anderson for a trip to one of my favourite parts of the world in search of some of Ireland's famous spirits. Today, I am delighted to be joined by author June Gosler Anderson to discuss her new book, Hauntings and History of the Emerald Isle. June, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we today?
Well, we're just fine. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure, June. My pleasure. Now, Hauntings and History of the Emerald Isle, as most people may gather, you're not actually from Ireland. However, you've had a real interest in the paranormal for quite a while. So what was it that led you to discover and take yourself to Ireland in regards to the paranormal, June?
Oh, that was Dave Schrader. And I think a lot of people are familiar with Dave. I had, starting in, well, 2007, I became a ghost tour for Anoka. And every September and October, I'd guide people through the haunted streets of Anoka and tell them stories about the history and about the people who once lived there and are probably still hanging around. And I also teach a class in community ed, and one of the community ed directors contacted me one day and says, "Hey, June, here's a class you might be interested in. Dave Schroeder is teaching a class on the paranormal."
Mm.
And I signed up for it. And in Dave's class, he mentioned they were planning a trip to Ireland, except it was full. So, but he went the next year too in 2015, and I signed up for that right away. And it was just such an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I learned so much. It was kind of like setting my foot in the waters. I really wasn't too, I didn't have a whole lot of knowledge about the paranormal. Maybe knowledge isn't the best word. Mm. I'd always thought that, I was just kind of neutral. Yeah, I've heard these stories, and some of them, maybe the door keeps swinging open because it's off balance and the like of that. But I learned a lot from Dave, and our trip started with a paracon in Boyle, which was a bit north of where we were traveling. It's also a capital for UFOs.
Yeah.
And there was a UFO conference going on at the same time. And so I sat at a table for lunch with Greg Lawson and one of the UFO guys, and it's just kind of the spider on the wall, you know, listening to the conversation.
Yeah.
But we had a series of lectures on various aspects of the paranormal. And I'll tell you, I had a hard time understanding some of those speakers. You know, my ears weren't tuned to the Irish dialect.
Yes.
But one stood out, and it wasn't even a speaker. It was a gentleman who just I happened to be talking to after one of the talks. And he told me, he said he had gone on a little expedition with a group, and they had gone to an ancient graveyard that was on one of the ley lines.
Mm.
And there were basically two graveyards that were connected by an underground tunnel. And so people would travel through the tunnel to get from one site to the other. And the trip took about 5 minutes walking. And the first group went through, and then his group went through. And when they emerged at the other end of the tunnel, they were astounded to find that their watches read an hour later than when they should have arrived. And the people at the other end were just frantic looking for them because they lost track of them. There were vents in the tunnel, and they hollered through the vents and no answer. And they were just gone for that period of time, and then they reemerged.
Mm.
And so there are stories of having to do with the fairy folk, I guess, that will enchant you and take you to other places that you don't remember.
Yeah, absolutely. Being pixie-led or fairy-led, as they call it.
So that's the term. And basically, that is my biggest memory of the Paracon. It was in a king's house.
Mm.
And we did have an investigation there, and I'm sure there were plenty of spirits around, but we didn't find any. So, but it was a real good introduction to the whole world of the paranormal.
Yeah.
Well, so then we just continued our trip by bus to the other spots, which there were quite a few places. I chose those that really struck out in my mind to write about. But at that, there's quite a few that I wrote about.
Yeah.
And when I got home, I decided that I am a writer. I've written about 10 books to date, several on the paranormal. I call it Traveling on the Dark Side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that I would do this book. And I had my notes, but I do a lot of research before I do the writing. And my idea is, you know, these places may be haunted, but why are they haunted and who's haunting them?
Yeah.
You know, ghosts doesn't just hop out of the closet and say boo.
Mm.
I mean, you know, what was it doing there? who is that ghost? What was it doing there? When was it roaming around in its human form on Earth? I like to delve into the history, and it just connects a lot of the pieces for me.
Well, Ireland is steeped in historical lore and also legends of ghosts. For as long as I've had an interest in the paranormal, June, Ireland has always given us some of the most spookiest places that one goes to. And like you say, when you went over to that Paracon and found out that there was a UFO conference happening at the same time, because obviously, as people may or may not know, as you refer to there, Boyle is allegedly the site of what is known as Ireland's version of the Roswell incident. So, so there's been a long-held tradition that a UFO crash-landed in Boyle in the mid-1990s, and that's where all that's come. But it has been known, because it's on the western side of Ireland, as a real area for people that have had UFO experiences and sightings out there. So I find that quite interesting that you went to the Paracon and it was happening at the same time as a UFO conference, which is, you know, if you're a lover of ghosts and ufology, you'd be a bit spoilt for choice there, June.
Yeah, well, and you know, the more I learn about this, the more I find that these realms are all interconnected somehow.
Mm.
You know, the paranormal or metaphysical, if you want to call it, science, religion, philosophy, literature, history, UFOs. You know, I'm beginning to see a lot of interconnections, and that's what makes the study so, the discipline so interesting. Yeah. And I really believe with the paranormal, we're coming out with a lot of equipment. Bill Chappell has pretty much pioneered that. And of course, there's all the shows on television and a lot of the interest in the paranormal now. But I think we're on the cutting edge of a new frontier. I think it's going to be revealed to us. And I'm I'm sorry, I'm probably not going to be around long enough to enjoy it, but I may be back.
Very true. So, I mean, I think probably that I would suspect, June, that the hardest part of writing your book about the hauntings in Ireland was deciding what to cover, really, because as I mentioned, Ireland has such a long tradition of locations and castles and forts and keeps and hauntings here, there and everywhere. It was probably as hard to work out what you weren't going to look into as it was what you fancied covering in the book.
Well, for one thing, I was limited by what we had actually visited. So everything that is in there is something that place we visited and experienced that I experienced myself. And I just added to my knowledge of that place. You know, I got home. And, well, for instance, with Left Castle.
Yeah.
It's we met Sean Ryan there, who is a fascinating man. He's a tin pipe player. And our group had the run of the place. We were the only ones there, and it was just a nice visit with him. And he told us a lot, but when I got home, it really whetted my appetite, you know, the story about Left Castle. And I delved into the history, which explains a lot of the hauntings that go on now. And it was the same with the other places. I just thoroughly researched them when I got home, and which always begs the question, you know, should I do this research before I go or when I come home, you know? I would do it. I would go to the place, research it, and then go back and see what I missed.
Yeah, yeah, very true. I mean, as you say, Lepp Castle is synonymous with hauntings in Ireland because it's probably one of the longest running places where strange things are supposed to occur, June. So how did you find it when you went there on your trip? Because obviously, as you refer to there, you probably didn't know as much about the castle and its history as you do now.
Right. I was kind of a blank slate when I went. You know, I read the itinerary. Okay, this is where we're going. And, you know, they had a few points of interest on it. But, and a lot of the people on the tour were familiar with it. But I was such a novice that I was just, you know, oh, okay. I just kind of absorbed what I found, what was told to me, and then went on from there. And I, you know, in retrospect, I think I enjoy my trips more when I get home.
Yes.
And really, you know, I look at the pictures and I delve into them, and I can just relive them again. And those are my memories of the trip. So I've been doing that a lot. And I find it makes it very real for me. You know, the trip itself is just the beginning of the experience.
I think that is the thing as well, especially as you say with Lepp, because there are two or three very famous alleged ghosts there. I know that probably one of the most infamous is the Bloody Chapel, which is supposed to be the home to a murdered priest who was tragically and brutally murdered in front of his family.
That was Thaddeus, yes. And it was One-Eyed Teague who murdered him. These were the Carrolls. And castle was built by the O'Bannon brothers, which was a plan. And I believe there's a couple of conflicting dates, but I believe it would be like the 13th century, you know, the 1200s.
Yeah.
And they were vying for chieftainship, who was going to be the leader of the clan. And so they had a competition, and which involved jumping over or jumping across something that was quite dangerous. And whoever made the jump would become the chieftain. And the surviving brother became the chieftain, and he built the castle. And so that's why it's called Left Castle. It's the left of the O'Bannons.
Yes.
And they lived in the castle for a while, and then it was taken over by the O'Carrolls. I don't know if it was a peaceful transition or otherwise, knowing the O'Carrolls, they were a very powerful clan. And if you travel in that part of Ireland, you see they're still prevalent. There's O'Carroll stores. Mm-hmm. And I went on a later trip. It was, I had a paranormal trip and a normal trip. And on the normal trip, we visited that area, but not Le Castle. And there was evidence of the O'Carrolls still being there. But they, when the father, Mulvaney, died, there were two brothers, Thaddeus. The older brother was the priest, and then there was one-eyed Teague, who was, you can only guess how he lost his eye.
Mm.
And they were vying for the chieftainship of the tribe, and one-eyed Teague solved the problem when the priest, Thaddeus, was saying mass. There's a high altar. Have you been in the Bloody Chapel?
I haven't. I've only been outside. I've not had a full tour of the area, so sadly, I've yet to. That will be. It's on my bucket list for when I go back to Ireland. I'm going to do a really spooky tour next time I go to.
Well, I got pictures of it in the book.
Fabulous.
Plus the spiral staircase that is even scarier than the chapel itself.
Mm.
But there is kind of carved into the, I don't know exactly how they did it, but there is a high altar in there that's just kind of carved into the wall. And they said that's where he would say mass. But one-eyed Teague came in as he was saying what mass one day and stabbed him, and he died across the altar. And ever since then, they've called it the Bloody Altar. Well, that solved the problem of who was going to be the clan leader, and this was one-eyed Teague. And he was, they were not really nice people, if you want to put it that way. They were very ambitious and very bloodthirsty. As I said in the book, bloodsport was their game.
Yes.
And they enlisted the aid of another clan to help them defeat one of their enemies. And this other clan was very skilled in the art of warfare. Mm. And so they trained Teague's men, one-eyed Teague's men, and together they defeated this other clan. And so Teague invited them to a victory dinner where they would get their just rewards. Well, rather than paying him, he kind of pulled a sneaky one on them. He put a drug. He drugged their drinks.
Mm.
And when they were unable to resist, he dragged them upstairs. Now, upstairs in the Bloody Chapel is an alcove. It looks kind of like a water closet. And there's a hole in it that you think was a water closet, but it wasn't. It was called the Oubliette.
Yes.
Which is French for the word forgotten.
Mm.
And the Bloody Chapel was like three stories higher than the ground floor. And they were thrown down this hole into the Oubliette, which was a type of dungeon.
Mm.
At the bottom of the Oubliette was a sharp spike, and the lucky ones landed on the spike and were killed instantly. The less fortunate were left to lie there, wounded and starving to death. And they could hear the sounds of merriment going on in the castle itself, but they and they could smell the food, but they were trapped. There was no escape from it. And that's where they died. This is where he threw the other tribe on an occasion. And I believe, and this is where my research came in. I think it was during the time of Cromwell, where the Scottish mercenaries, the Scots were coming in, the Scots-Irish, to take over the lands of the Irish.
Mm.
And a lot of them were hired as mercenaries. And from what I could piece together, and this is kind of going out on a limb, but I think that they were besieging the castle and were defeated, and the survivors of this were also thrown down the oubliette. And the proof of this is, we'll jump forward in history to about 1922 and after. Or maybe it was even later. Maybe it was 1958 when they started restoring the castle. But he dug up 3 cartloads of bones.
Yeah.
And determined they belonged to, I believe, 300 individuals.
Yes.
Who met their death at the hands of Teague O'Carroll. And, you know, people who die a violent death very often are not, haven't crossed over yet. They're not quite aware of what happened.
And yes.
They're still around.
It is one of those places as well, June, because I know, I think when they were doing, I think it was the restoration as you refer to there in the 1950s, I think they also were saying that they came across a pocket watch from the 18th century, which kind of gives you the worrying interpretation of, well, how long were they using this dungeon to get rid of people, you know?
Yeah, or did some stupid visitor just decide to check the time and he dropped it? Oh, whoops.
Yeah, well, you'd hope.
So, yeah, that's another kind of chilling tale with that. So, except it had been, the O'Carrolls were no longer there in the 18, I think it was 1850 it was engraved.
Yeah.
The O'Carrolls had left by then. With the coming of Cromwell, they were holding off against the English as long as they could. And with the coming of Cromwell, they had to give up the castle. And interestingly enough, they figure into American history. And there were many of them immigrated to America at the time or just before independence in later 1700s. One of them became, I think it was Charles O'Carroll. Yeah, Charles O'Carroll of Carrollton.
Yes.
Became a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And he was from Maryland, which was a Catholic colony in the New World, which was mainly Protestant. And he was the last surviving signer of the Declaration, and they attribute the fact that the Bill of Rights has freedom of religion, by religion, for religion, encompassed in it, is due to his efforts, because he was a Catholic in a very Protestant country. He is very famous in that part. In fact, I was just in Washington, D.C. for Thanksgiving, and there is a kind of a park, or not even a park, but there's it's a circle of stone slabs with the names of the signers of the Declaration of Independence engraved on it. And I took the picture of his slab. It's kind of exciting, you know, when you can link it up. Another, his cousin was the first Catholic bishop in the New World in the Americas. So they came in and they made their mark here. And throughout that part of the country, there's a lot of counties that are named Carroll County. They dropped the O from O'Carroll. So that's what happened to that contingent at the time of Cromwell. And Lech Castle itself was given to Jonathan Darby. Now, there's two stories about that. The romantic one is that the first Jonathan, who was actually Jonathan II Darby, was a prisoner in Lech Castle who was befriended by the daughter of the O'Carrolls, who fell in love with him and arranged for his freedom. And as they were escaping, they were accosted by her brother, and Darby slew him with a sword. And then the daughter was heir to the castle, and he took her hand in marriage, and that's how the Darbys became owners, the proprietors of Lech Castle. Well, there's a lot of holes in it. First of all, nobody escaped from the dungeon. How did he get the sword, et cetera, et cetera? The more prosaic approach to that is that Darby was in Cromwell's army and was rewarded the castle in lieu of payment for his services.
Mm.
So anyways, he married and took over the castle, and they had a son whose name was Jonathan III, and he was called Wild Jack. He was English, of course,
mm-hmm.
and again, I'm piecing the story together here. You know what, how it probably went down,
yes.
Is that in fighting with the English against the Irish, he attained treasure, wealth, and treasure that he buried on the grounds of Luck Castle.
Mm.
And a couple of servants help him. But he was a little paranoid, and he was afraid that if they knew where it was, they might just dig it up and take off with it. So he murdered them, and so nobody knew where the treasure was.
Mm.
Well, the tides of fortune, the tides of war changed, and he was captured by the Irish and put in prison and sentenced to be hung, drawn, and quartered for treason, which was, you know, capital punishment in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't carry out the sentence immediately, and he languished in prison until, again, the tide of war turned. And I believe this was with William the Orange taking the throne. He was released from prison, but the time he had spent there had kind of deranged his mind. He was known as Mad Jack.
Mm.
And he returned to Luck Castle and hoping to regain his treasure, but he couldn't remember where he buried it. And unfortunately, the only ones who knew were dead.
Yes.
And so one of the tales is that his ghost is out there still looking for his buried treasure. And the castle was occupied by a succession of Darbys. And the last one, I call him Jonathan the Last.
Yes.
Inherited from his grandfather, and I believe the year was 1880. And he married Mildred Dill, who was an English woman. This was not a love match. Jonathan was 35. Mildred was 20. Jonathan was very arrogant. He was cruel. He was just not a nice guy.
Yeah.
I guess we call him an abusive husband now.
Mm.
Mildred had literary talents, but this was frowned upon. She was from England, and this was frowned upon by her parents, whose religion just forbade women to dabble in anything as unsightly as literary arts, especially writing. And so they married her off to Jonathan and shipped her off to England.
Mm.
Well, there were complaints. Well, for his wedding gift, he enlarged the castle. At that time, it was just the keep, but he added wings onto the castle. And to pay for it, he sold off land that his tenant farmers depended on for farming, and he raised the taxes on them. And he was just not a real popular guy at all. I mean, he's kind of a stinker.
Mm.
There were complaints about our stories about the murdered servant. And in tearing down a wall in his excavation, they did discover the bodies of three people buried behind one of the walls, which may hold up for the murdered servant story. So Jonathan and Mildred lived in the castle. Jonathan was away on business quite a bit, which was very fortunate for Mildred because he was just, well, it's nice to get him out of the house. They had four children who had no love for his father because he treated them as cruelly as his wife. But the good news was he was gone a lot. And in that time, Mildred became interested in the paranormal, the gothic, and she would hold seances at the castle with her friends.
Mm.
And it's said that with these seances, they invoked the spirits of some of the restless ghosts that were wandering around, and one of them was called an elemental.
Mm.
This is a creature that was probably put in place by the pagans, the castle was a sacred site even before the castle was built. And it's thought that the pagans put an elemental in place to guard it.
Mm.
And probably these spirits coalesced into the spirit of the elemental, which many people had seen, and Mildred especially had encountered it. And I have, in my book, I have Mildred's description of it, that it was a sheep-sized, very gruesome, sockets for eyes. It smelled like death. And she encountered it on several occasions. Well, Mildred, with all of these spiritual adventures, was writing Gothic novels. And she wrote under the name of Andrew Mary because she could never publish as a woman.
Yes.
And she even had the strong voice of a man. She had a masculine voice in her writing. And her novels were very, very popular. And she did keep the secret hidden from Jonathan until he discovered it and forbade her to write and to publish. Well, being the dutiful wife, she did not publish any more of her stories, but she did keep on writing them. And she hid them in a cabinet in the castle. Actually, Jonathan encountered the elemental one day, and he was furious, and he accused Mildred of dressing up one of the servants to make a fool of him, and it wasn't really the case. Well, that was 1915. Well, fast forward a few years to like 1921, an uprising is in the air. The Irish, there have been several uprisings, and we can talk about one of them with Enniscorthy Castle.
Yes.
But probably the final, well, not the final, but the one that turned the tide was the uprising of 1922. And this was brewing, so Jonathan had time to remove his family and his possessions from Lepp Castle and ship them off to England, except Mildred's manuscripts were still locked in the cabinet in the castle. Well, in 1922, the townspeople were so mad at Jonathan and at the Darbys for what they had done, that of course the way you get even with these Englishmen who've taken over your castles is to blow up the castles. So they groundskeeper warning, and he got out of there, and they burned the castle, and they put bombs in it, and they did a real number on the castle.
Yeah.
And including Mildred's manuscripts, which had been locked away. Jonathan wasn't affected. In fact, he came back a year or so later after everything had cooled off from the government, was able to collect remuneration for the damage that had been done to the castle. So he came out okay. He and Mildred returned to England. Jonathan remained in Ireland, and that was pretty much the end of their marriage. So the castle was deserted for the next, well, till 1958, when Peter came. He was a descendant of the O'Bannons and bought the castle and started renovating it. But the townspeople would say the castle was boarded up, gates around it were locked. But they said if you passed by there late at night, you could see a flash of lights in the bloody castle as if the ghosts were, I always say, having a party.
Probably happy for a bit of peace and quiet, June.
I don't know. I think that they enjoy company myself.
Well, I suppose it depends on the type of company, though.
I hear that some of those, you know, investigators get pretty macho. You'll get out here and show yourself. Well, hey, wait a minute. I dig. You know, you get out of here.
Yeah, very true. Very true. It is, like you say, it seems to be just steeped in so many sad stories and weird things, that place, Lepp Castle. It just seems to have attracted people. And I know, you know, as you touched on with the originality and the history of the building, you know, people were quite violent at certain periods of time. So, but it does seem that that particular area seems to have attracted a certain type of person as well.
Well, you know, they talk about negative energy. And that basically, you know, I think, well, if you go into a prison, you know, you feel the negative energy. And by the way, prisons are supposedly very haunted and not really dangerously haunted.
Mm.
But, you know, some people sense this negativity, this negative energy, the evil in a place just the minute they approach it.
Yeah. I mean, in comparison to, as and you slightly mentioned it there, June, Enniscarthy Castle certainly doesn't have the probably an international reputation like Lepp does, but it's certainly a very well-known haunted location. How did you find it when on your visit?
Well, we actually visited with the ghosts there. It was, you know, most of it I hear stories because I'm not psychic. I don't have a sixth sense. I'm basically an observer, which is probably a good place to be when you're dealing with this.
Mm.
Because that gives you some protection.
Yes.
But we did have some experiences there. Enniscorthy is in Wexford, which is on the southeast coast of Ireland. The castle, like many Irish castles, you know, changed hands. But in the rising, during the rising of 1798, it was in the hands of the English. And across the way from Enniscorthy is a hill. It's known as Vinegar Hill.
Yes.
Which figures into this history. Well, in 1798, there were a lot of risings across Ireland, which were pretty swiftly put down by the English, except in Wexford. And there, the pikemen were able to hold off the Englishmen for a month, which was unthinkable. But in the end, Irish pikemen are no match for English muskets, and they were finally overthrown. Although there was a hole in the English lines that allowed a lot of the Irish to escape. Those that weren't so lucky to escape were hauled off to Enniscorthy. And as any good castle worth its merit, worth its salt, it had a dungeon, which was hewn out of the rock that it was built on.
Mm.
And they were thrown in this dungeon to basically languish until they died. When we visited Enniscorthy, the castle was in beautiful shape. In fact, it had been lived in by an English couple for many years until 1950s, maybe.
Yes.
When they turned it over to the Wexford Historical Society, and they made a museum out of it. And the Wexford Paranormal Society will host groups in there. And we were their guests on this night.
Mm.
And it was a moonlit night. I think it was the night of the blood moon. It was a large moon.
Mm.
And I remember seeing it kind of perched atop one of the parapets of the castle. It was quite a sight. But Michael Benson was our host, and he greeted us and brought us in. And there were about 40 of us in the group. And we had an orientation with the Wexford Paranormal Society, and we were divided into four groups. My group stayed in the living room, and I was kind of surprised because they rolled up this huge rug that covered the floor, where it was just wooden floor. And on this, there was a television tray, you know, like the wooden ones that are so common all over.
Yes.
They had a light shining on the legs of the tray, so we could see there wasn't anything connected to it.
Mm.
And the lights were dimmed. And we were instructed to, a number of us, to place our fingertips lightly on the top of the table.
Mm.
While we did this, our guide from the Wexford Paranormal Society was talking to whatever spirit happened to be in the room. And she said, it's usually Andrew or John, she said, and they're not friends.
Mm.
But in talking to her, she said, well, show us that you're here, you know, just make the table move. And the table started tipping a little bit back and forth.
Mm.
And we weren't doing it. There was no way we could do it because of the weight of our fingertips. We couldn't really move the table. And so it tipped, and we were pretty impressed by this. But she said, sometimes that table tips all the way to the floor. and, you know, unbelievable. Well, our next station that our group went to was a room that was dark, and it had kind of a rough table on it. And there was a glass, a short squat glass with an electric votive under it. It worked kind of like a Ouija board.
Yeah.
And we could actually, if one of the ghosts was in there, we could communicate to the ghost this way. And so, again, we were instructed to put our fingers lightly on top of this glass and ask it questions. If it moves sideways, it was a yes. If it slashed downwards, it was a no. And it would also spell out short answers. Mm-hmm. So we started asking it questions. And I have that dialogue. Sometimes I remember things verbatim.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things that I pretty much remembered. So naturally, the first question was, what is your name? And the glass spelled out, Andrew. When did you die? 1798. And that was the year of the uprising. Mm. How old were you when you died? And the glass said, 23. Were you an Irishman? And the glass indicated, yes. Were you captured? Again, yes. Then what happened? And the glass spelled out, dungeon. How long were you there? 6 months. Did you die there? Yes. Were you married? No. Did you have a sweetheart? Yes. And we learned that she later married. Did you live in Wexford? No. Where did you live? 5 miles. Then we tried to find out his profession, and we were racking our brains trying to think of, you know, what a person might have been doing over 200 years ago. So we named farmer, cooper, no, blacksmith, no. All the trades and occupations we could think of that were relevant at the time. And each was answered with a downward slash, no. And somebody said, were you a soldier? And bingo, the glass said, yes. And did you kill anyone? No. And then we learned later that John, this was Andrew answering our questions, and we learned that John was one of the British soldiers who was one of the prison guards, basically. For obvious reasons, they didn't like each other very well.
Mm.
But, and we learned from another group, they asked, you know, how did you die? And it was bayonet to the throat. But John was apparently not his killer. So we left that room kind of stunned and awed. Mm-hmm. And we met another group. There's a group that was coming out of the table tilting room. And one of them was a good friend of mine, Faye. She had been in that group, and I heard bits and pieces of the story. And later in Minneapolis, I had coffee with Faye, and I said, Faye, what happened in that room? And she told me that they were in with a tipping table, and they had their fingers on the table, and one in the party was a rather attractive blonde girl.
Mm.
That apparently the spirit took a liking to because the table started tipping violently back and forth and back and forth all the way to the floor. And then it took off. It started chasing this girl.
Oh.
And those with their fingers on top of it were running to keep up. And it chased her into the next room and cornered her against a bed. And she was terrified.
Yeah.
And Faye said, I coaxed it back into the other room, calmed it down and coaxed it back. And so we all went back into the other room. And it turns out that it was John, and he apparently was a bit horny. So that was her story. And then we, our third station was in one of the parapets. This castle is a keep, and it's a drum castle. It's surrounded by four drum towers, one on each corner, and then they have a parapet on top.
Yeah.
And so we went up to one of the parapets with a Frank's box. And as you know, a Frank's box is it's kind of a radio. that keep switching frequencies to try and find a frequency that any ghost flying through might find convenient and might just leave a message on. So I find them really annoying because they're so full of static.
Yes.
But apparently they do work from time to time. So we went up there because we thought, well, if any spirits were winging their way through, you know, it'd be a good place to catch them. But because of the traffic, it was too noisy to get anything out of it. So we took the Frank's box down to the dungeon. And as we were coming out of there, a group was coming up laughing like mad. And they said, yes, you did, Jeff. And no, I didn't do it. Yes, you did. Yes, you did. And they were teasing Jeff, one of the guys in the group, mercilessly. And so we went down to the dungeon, which is not a comfortable place. You know, it doesn't have a flat floor. And we were standing there. I'm trying to brace myself against a wall, but the floor is kind of sloping away from the wall, and I kept sliding down. But we put the Frank's box in the middle of the floor, and one of the guys said, when the last group was here, there was a rather embarrassing incident. Can you tell us who did it? And I don't know if you can spell out the incident, but it was a loud, rather rude noise. and the box said, Jeff. And it said, Jeff, Jeff, Jeff. So, you know, we have proof conclusive that Jeff was the culprit. And so with that, we went back upstairs, and the Wexford Paranormal Society had prepared us a lovely snack. And we teased Jeff some more, and he still insists that he didn't do it. In fact, I've been with him on later trips, and he still say, no, it wasn't me. So... So that was our story with that. When I was researching this, I wanted to get stories from the group as well. And I had to get their pictures because I had taken all of mine on an iPad, which I lost and never found. And there, a lot of the pictures, you'll see credits from other people who were kind enough to send me their pictures, but also their stories. And one of the interesting stories I got from Sharon Leong and her sister Anne, and I'll read it for you. Well, my sister and I were in the dungeon of Enniscorthy Castle. The spirits we communicated with claimed that they are alive and that they actually live in another dimension, not ghosts, but other dimensional beings in the dungeon with us that night. You know, those spirits have been hanging around the castle for over 200 years and probably playing pranks on each other to amuse themselves. So you think they might have been putting us on as well?
Yeah, I think there might be a bit of leg pulling going on there, June.
I kind of think so. You know, it was like, you know, back to UFOs and the six, all the dimensions. But I thought about it. I said, I don't know about that.
Well, Enniscorthy is quite a haunted location as well, because I think the one thing that's quite striking about the castle is it's essentially in the town centre, isn't it, as well? So it's quite unusual, because a lot of castles are on their own or they've got their own grounds, whereas it seems like the town of Enniscorthy has grown up around the castle. And I know that there is a theatre that there is next door to the castle, which also has a long history of haunting, but is fairly modern. So
yeah, theatres are notorious for being haunted. I didn't know about that theatre, though.
I've got a couple of things about that, because it was I'd never heard of the castle, but I'd heard of the ghosts in the theatre, strangely enough.
Oh, good. Yeah, what about them?
Well, they're the usual, typical theatre ghosts that they tend to, you know, they're the ones that sort of, people hear them whispering in their wings, and occasionally they'll see people walking about when they're on stage doing dress rehearsals and things like that, and lights go on and off, and makeup and things disappears from the dressing room. So, you know, the typical mischievous theatre ghosts that we get, June.
You know where they would really come in handy? I do some theater work, and I memorizing lines is like, oh, God, you know. It would really be nice if you had a theater ghost as your muse who would whisper your lines in your ears.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I've spoken to a couple of paranormal investigators, Mike Huberty, strangely enough, who's also from Wisconsin. And we were talking about a ghost in a theater as well that always whispers to people, good luck, when they go on stage.
Yeah, it'd be a lot better if they just tell you your lines. You know, the ghostly prompter.
Yes.
That would be, yeah.
Absolutely.
I might write a book about that.
So one of the other places you visited in Ireland that has a well-known history is Duncannon Fort, which is one of those places where it's once again had a very tumultuous past, June, and it's, you know, seen scenes of violence and attempts to take it, because I think Cromwell failed in his attempt to take the fort and had to leave with his tail between his legs until later on and someone else managed to get hold of it. But that's another place I think you visited on your trip as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and just kind of skipping past the history, there is the story there of, I'm just kind of looking for it, because there are two forts.
Mm.
One is Charles Fort and one is Duncannon.
Yes.
And I have been in both of them, but I was kind of looking for the stories, and in, I believe with Duncannon Fort, it was one of the few places in County Wexford that did not fall under United Irishmen during the 1798 rebellion. You know, back to that, it was still controlled by the English, and it was defended by Irishmen who were called the Crappie Boys.
Yes.
Due to their short or cropped haircuts. After the fall of Wexford, these Crappie Boys were rounded up and sent to cells, and then they were hung as traitors. And one of those, actually a song was written about him. It was a young boy who was hung along with the others.
Mm.
And the song, I wrote a verse of the song. There's many more verses, but I did put this verse in my book. 'Twas in Duncannon this young man died, and in Duncannon his body lies. So all good people who do pass by, just drop a tear for the Crappie Boy.
Mm.
It was the story of the poor unfortunate lad who's seeking to escape from the British. And at the same time, a British soldier was trying to get away from the Irish mob. And so the British soldier, to escape, goes into a church and he grabs a priest's vestment and he hides out in the confessional. And the Crappie Boy is seeking absolution for his sins. He enters the confessional and pours his heart out to the British soldier priest, who, upon hearing his story, turns him over to the authorities. He's dragged up to the dungeons below Duncannon. And this verse that I just read is about this poor Crappie Boy who was hung for seeking absolution.
Yeah.
So, and some have heard the boy's cries, and others have witnessed the ghost of this tragic young figure.
Hey.
So, and there's sightings of spirit ghosts and phantoms and prisoners. Now they're creeping going on in Duncannon. So it's home to numerous phantoms, shadows, disembodied voices. And they've even seen a paranormal patrol of soldiers in the courtyard keeping watch out for a phantom enemy. And the fort's mess hall houses one of the location's most active ghosts, featuring the soldier of the ghost of a soldier who took his own life. And it's a love story. It was a love triangle, and this lowly soldier had the unfortunately fell in love with the wife of his commanding officer, who loved him in return. But faced with the prospect of unrequited love, the soldier took his own life. And it's said that his ghost also haunts Duncannon Fort. I've been to the fort. You know, I think it would be a good project for restoration. It's fascinating, but so much of it is destroyed. And Duncannon, I believe, was blown up during the 1922 rebellion.
Yes.
By the Irish.
Mm.
And they do a really good job on their historical places of destroying them. but it would be really neat to see that place restored.
Yeah.
So another place we visited was Charles Fort.
Yes.
Been there?
No, I have heard of it because it's supposed to be haunted by one of our typical British ghosts, an Irish ghost, which is a white lady, June.
Yes, well, I have the story of the white lady in my book.
Mm.
And her name was Winifred. And she fell in love with Colonel Warrender.
Mm.
No, her father was, she was Winifred Warrender.
Mm.
And she fell in love with Trevor, who was an up-and-coming commander in at the regiment stationed there. And they had a beautiful love affair going. And on the day of their wedding, Winifred and Trevor went for a hike along the battlements. And these rise high above, right on the English Channel. And Winifred spied some beautiful flowers on the bank leading up to the wall in the battlement, and she just said, "Oh, I would love to have some of those flowers."
Mm.
Well, Trevor decided that he would, you know, her wish was his command.
Yes.
So they had a beautiful wedding, and, you know, the whole garrison turned out, except for the soldiers who were in the guard towers, keeping watch for any incoming, probably Spanish ships at that time.
Yeah.
There was a lot of merriment, a lot of dancing, a lot of drinking. And Trevor decided that he would fill his wife's dream of having some of those beautiful wildflowers as a wedding gift. So he went along the battlement and he approached the soldier in the sentry tower and commanded him to go down and pick some of the wildflowers. Now, the sentry was between a rock and a hard place because to abandon your post was punishable by death.
Mm.
And there were similar punishments for disobeying a commanding officer.
Yes.
So, you know, okay, what's he going to do? Well, Trevor, sensing his plight, said, "I'll stand watch for you while you go picking the wildflowers."
Mm.
So he stood watch in the along the sentry post. He kind of leaning over his rifle. And it took the sentry a while because it was quite a scramble. In the meantime, Winifred's father, Colonel Warrender, was taking a walk along the wall, inspecting the sentry post to make sure everybody was doing their duty, when he came upon this one sentry post with the sentry's back turned to him, and he was slumped over his musket, obviously asleep.
Mm.
Well, the colonel was furious with this, and he took out his pistol and he shot him in the back through the heart. And he commanded other troops to come up and remove this body and bring it to the square where he would use it as an example of what happens to sentries who fall asleep at their post. And so they brought it down to the square. They turned the body over, and lo, it was Trevor, the bridegroom, dead, shot dead by his father-in-law.
Mm.
Well, both Winifred and the colonel or the commander were just aghast at what had happened. And that night, Winifred was walking the parapets. Should have been the night of her honeymoon. Instead, she was walking the wall, and she came to the sentry tower. And her grief was so great that she just flung herself over the walls and into the depths of the sea.
Mm.
And the colonel was so consumed with guilt and sadness that he killed himself as well. And so they say to this day that Winifred, the white lady, you can see her walking the parapets on her wedding night in her wedding gown. but of course her lover, her husband, has been shot dead by her father. So it's a very tragic story. You know, one interesting thing is about ghosts is that, you know, it can be a reoccurring ghost.
Mm.
Where the scene was so tragic and made such an impression that with the right conditions, it just repeats itself over and over. In time, you know, the white lady may fade to the gray lady, may fade to the transparent lady, to nothing. But after time, you know, maybe the real kind of the film wears out. And they're gone.
Yeah, a bit like the stone tape theory, June, where, because it's such an emotional event, and, you know, and obviously, you know, the loss of your son-in-law, and then the fact that your daughter then kills herself as well because she's overcome with grief, and you take your own life because of what you've done. That is such an emotional outpouring of events that appeared, you know, that happened over such a small period of time. If anything was going to sort of imprint itself on the very environment it's based in, it would be something such an emotionally charged story as that, wouldn't it?
It would. You know, speaking of stone tape theory, that was, I read about that in Richard Felix's book, I think it was Ghost, when I was in England a couple of years later, and we had a delightful tour with him, and yes, I bought his book, which was fascinating. But maybe, why don't you tell us about the stone tape theory?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I've got story read. I'd like to hear from someone else.
Well, as my understanding and everything I've ever said is that there will be certain emotional environmental situations, June, that will allow an event or emotions to imprint themselves on a building or an area, that will occasionally, once again, when the perhaps someone is there who is feeling emotionally charged either way, or the environment or the weather even is at such a point, that it will cause the event that caused the original incident to repeat itself to the witnesses. And it's a long held tradition that, as you refer to, in some instances the stone tape eventually gets weaker and weaker the longer it's gone on, and eventually will cease. But in certain some incidences, that the event is so emotionally charged that it will continue regardless and will always repeat itself for whoever is there in the right time frame for it to occur.
Yeah, you know, he explained a little bit of the technology behind this too, that to liken it to a videotape, or what is it, a tape on your VHS?
Yes.
Yeah, or tape recorder, that these are basically silicon tapes with iron particles that pick up the magnetism, picks up the image.
Yeah.
And if you look at a building, you know, there's your silicone in the stone or the brickwork. And of course, there's iron in, especially in Minnesota.
Yes.
In so much of the stone that, you know, this would, magnetism in this would attract it and record it. You know, I said we're on the next frontier, you know, where technology is kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, that kind of works.
Yeah, very true, because one of the things I know about where you live is one of my favorite ghosts in the whole of your state, June. Is known, I believe it's known as the grey-clad ghost, which is allegedly a gentleman called Bill Andberg, who used to jog. So that's supposed to be a recurring ghost of people seeing him jog through the local area. Is that right?
Yeah. What have you heard about him?
Well, he's one of those where he was known for being a regular jogger, and he would always wear a certain outfit when he went jogging. And he's still sighted on certain occasions where people will see him just running through certain areas.
Well, yeah, just to add to this story, I remember when he was alive even, he was a doctor, and he was a jogger, but his favorite jogging place was the cemetery in Anoka.
Yes.
And he would jog along these cemetery trails. And so it is said that people visiting the cemetery may see him from time to time. It's called the Gray Ghost. And his outfit was always like gray sweats that he wore. But that's interesting that that story has gotten all the way across the big divide from, you know, us to you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll watch any documentary that mentions ghosts in the title, usually, June, and I like to watch ghost collections about different states and areas of America because it's interesting and it takes me and takes me to places that I've never heard of or only know a very little amount about. So that was always one that's really struck with me because it's quite a unique ghost that you've got somebody who's still jogging in the afterlife.
Well, I am just I haven't thought much about it. I'm so glad you brought it up.
Oh, well,
because like, yeah, he was a local legend while he was alive, and I guess he still is while he's dead. And what better place, you know, than Anoka?
Absolutely, yeah, very true. Because I know when we spoke before we started the interview proper, we were talking about the fact that Anoka is known as the Halloween capital of the world, June, because this year should have been the centenary of the first parade that was done to try and stop the local youths causing uproar and mayhem as they did on All Hallows Eve in the past.
Okay, well, in 2000, my husband died in 2007. And I pretty much decided, okay, I'm going to start a new chapter in my life and just explore things. And Anoka had fascinated me. I'd been on a couple of ghost tours, and I decided that I would become a ghost tour guide for Anoka. And so I did. And as I said before, I was kind of neutral about this. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, I don't believe or disbelieve. You know, people have had these experiences, and in whom I did say, oh, you're crazy. But as I was giving the tours, people would start telling me their stories. And I heard some pretty good ones. So I started thinking, well, maybe there's more to it. Well, Anoka is known as the Halloween capital of the world, and they've really capitalized on it.
Yes.
But back at the beginning of the last century, Halloween, which is All Saints, All Hallows Eve, because All Saints Day is the next day, and the legends have it that the dead, the spirits rise from the grave for a night of mischief upon this earth. And in Anoka, as in many other places, they were aided in their mischief by the local spirits who weren't quite dead yet. My dad was one of them in his day. And they would do things like tip over outhouses and soak windows. And in Anoka, they were especially ingenious. One Halloween, a group of enterprising young spirits took apart a buggy and reassembled it on top of the courthouse. And another Halloween, they had released a herd of cows in the street, down Main Street. They got into the local jail and also a classroom where it's reported they ate a few algebra books. Well, some of the pranks were getting pretty mean. And the local citizenry was talking about arming themselves.
Yes.
And so the city fathers decided they didn't want this mayhem in their fair cities. So they thought, okay, maybe if we have something going on to distract them, they won't be creating so much mischief on Halloween. So they organized a parade, and they invited everyone to be in it. The school children were invited to wear costumes and march in it. They had float, they had the high school band, they had the Legionnaires band, and they even had the nurses from the Anoka Insane Asylum marching in the parade. And after that, they had a big citywide party. And it was so much fun that they decided to do it the next year, which they did. It was even bigger and better. And so every year, they have had this big celebration. They have not only one parade now, but two parades. And one Saturday parade and then an evening parade, which, by the way, isn't held on Halloween necessarily. But they do party. There's a lot of decorations up in the town and that. So this has continued for 100 years, except for 2 years during World War II, when they didn't think it would be patriotic And ironically, 2020, this is centennial year, when everything was shut down. But Anoka still celebrates this heritage, and we hope to get back to it again pretty soon. I had a lot of fun leading these. Actually, I do a talk on it. I developed some PowerPoint talks. One of them is on Ghosts of Anoka, which is for civic events, a lot of senior facilities like me to come in. It's a PowerPoint, so I've got a lot of pictures as well as the stories with it. And I've got one on Ireland also.
Ah, fantastic.
So I've been hoping to do them over Zoom, but they kind of like them live, so yeah. I can hardly wait to get back to that.
So what's next for you now, June? What's your next project after this book on the history of Ireland and its wonderful ghosts? Where are you planning on going next, or what's your next writing project about?
Well, I am really looking forward to a paranormal trip to Scotland. It was planned with Dave. We had planned it for last September, but guess what happened?
Yeah.
It's been rebooked for June, and with a little luck and some immunization, maybe it will be safe to go. It will complete my trilogy. I was in England with Dave in the paranormal group. I was also in Romania, Transylvania, with them. But it will complete my British Isles tour.
Yeah.
And I think I may read up on it a bit more before I go.
So have you got any particular places you're going to visit when you go to Scotland then, June?
Well, we have the itinerary. And I know Loch Ness was, and I'm not too familiar with the places. We did have an itinerary. Whether those will still hold for this trip, I don't know. But I'd really love to have your input on it.
Well, you can't go to Scotland and not go to Edinburgh. That's all I'll say, especially if you're doing ghosts.
Okay, so, all right, Edinburgh. How about Glasgow, is that?
Yeah, Glasgow's got a very spooky history as well. They both the major cities in Scotland, Glasgow and Edinburgh, are both steeped in paranormal lore. Edinburgh more so, because it has a very infamous ghost known as the Mackenzie Poltergeist, which, depending on which source you read, is either the best advertised ghost hunt in the country, or it's a really nasty ghost. I'll just say that.
Okay. So, yeah, well, we have a few sites here that I would like to go. I would like to visit, like Salem.
Yes.
This book, the book was originally History and Hauntings of the Emerald Isle, which I published under my own publishing company, which is Granny Girl Press.
Yep.
And Dave called me one day and said, "Hey, June, there's a paranormal publishing company known as Beyond the Fray is interested in reprinting it." So I talked to them, and we got together on it. They did the book basically verbatim. I added some stuff about Mildred Darby, basically, to Les Castle. We screened the pictures. So the book came out with a wonderful cover, very much unlike mine, which was kind of prosaic. And it's now called Hauntings and History of the Emerald Isle. They reversed it.
Yes.
In talking to them, I told them about my next project, and it's also one I do a talk on. It's Tracking Dracula. In 2018, I went with Dave and my paranormal peeps to Romania.
Yes.
And we visited the castles, which are in beautiful shape, by the way,
yes,
that are associated with Vlad the Impaler, who was the prototype for Bram Stoker's Dracula. And so the book encompasses more than Romania. It starts basically with Bram Stoker.
Yes.
And have you ever been to St. Michael's in Dublin?
Yes, I have. I've been. Dublin's one of my favourite places in the entire world. I love it. I've been 3 or 4 times.
Have you been in the crypts?
Yes, I have been in the crypts. Yeah, I've done the whole tour, and I've been in the wonderful university and the library, and I did the ghost tour in Dublin as well.
But my story starts with Bram Stoker, And a lot of his influence, or a lot that influenced him, was in the crypt, you know, where those mummies were.
Mm.
And then it tells about Bram Stoker. In fact, I was at a author talk in our library in Anoka County here, and I met Zachary Stoker,
yes,
who is his great grandnephew, who has written a book called Draco. And I've been reading the book. I have my picture with Zachary, wishing me good luck on the talk that I was getting together, Tracking Dracula.
Mm.
And just a handsome man. Wow. But so anyways, it goes from Bram Stoker's early beginnings in Dublin. He was a Dubliner. To England, where he worked for Sir Henry Irving, who is a leading stage actor, Shakespearean actor of the time.
Yes, very famous.
Also had it, and I've got some of his story, and also Ellen Terry.
Mm.
By the way, my daughter, I was taking Shakespeare when I was pregnant with my daughter. Her name is Terry Ellen.
Ah.
Talk about influence there. But and it goes up to Whitby, England, which we visited on our England tour. You know, that beautiful ruin.
Yes.
And that's where, in the Dracula story, Dracula comes ashore.
He does, yes.
When he lands. And so, and from there, I take it from Dracula coming ashore to our Romanian excursion and the Hunyadi Castle, Corbin Castle, and kind of the Reign of Terror of Vlad the Impaler.
Mm.
I mean, when we talk about tough times to be living in Ireland, you know, during Cromwell and that.
Yep.
I mean, man impaled. He murdered 80,000 people and impaled 20,000 of them.
Mm.
You know, about horrible times to be living. But I've tracked his story and these castles associated with him in the history. And I've put it together now as a paranormal presentation, and I'm planning to expand on it, bring in probably a little more of the travelogue of places to visit in Romania, Transylvania, Wallachia, especially.
Mm.
And either, you know, I'll do it myself as Granny Girl Press, or if Beyond the Fray is interested, you know, have it published by them. So, it's exciting, you know. There's just, the more you learn, the more there is to know.
Absolutely. Very true. Well, that's fantastic, and I look forward to seeing that, June, whichever way it comes. So, if anybody's interested in your work and wants to get hold of a copy of your wonderful book or follow your previous books that you've released, where can they find your website and find some more details? Tells them where to get them.
Okay, my books are all listed on Amazon. You can find it under my name, June Gosler Anderson, which lists all of them. They're not all paranormal. I've got two children's books in there and a couple of basically autobiographies.
Yeah.
And I've got History and Haunting of the Anoka Masonic Lodge is one of my paranormal, as well as this. So Amazon.com, under my name or under the title of the book, Haunting and History of the Emerald Isle.
Mm-hmm.
And Beyond the Fray also has them.
Yep.
The publisher who could be contacted.
Well, that's fabulous. Well, like I say, June, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it and following your investigations and explorations of Ireland, and it clearly had a big impact on you as a tourist and as a lover of the paranormal. So thank you for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you, and I wish you the continued success with your writing.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. It was a pleasure to be on your show.